You guys can hear me? Welcome to my workshop, the basement. I think you've seen this maybe once or twice before. It is currently a balmy 53 degrees down here right now. So I'm wearing an extra layer. not too bad though. So tonight we're going to be studying Exodus chapter 20. Last week I was talking about Exodus chapter 19. I'll just do a quick review of chapter 19. So the Israelites had been wandering through the desert a little bit, and they had finally arrived at Mount Sinai, and God prepared them to basically have him meet with them. And he came down on the mountain in great smoke and fire and thunder. Looking at chapter 20, actually wasn't turned there. Give me a moment. Exodus chapter 20. We're going to bounce around a little bit through the Bible, so hope you have your Bible page-turning hands ready. So chapter 20 is laid out sort of in two main sections. The biggest section goes from verse 1 through verse 21, where God is speaking directly to the people, and he speaks the Ten Commandments that they hear. And so that the Ten Commandments take us all the way through verse 17. And then there's the people's response from verse 18 through 21. And then the last bit of the chapter is from 22 through 26, where God is speaking to Moses and he gives some extra laws about altars. And that kind of flows and continues on to chapter 21. So we'll start just by giving a brief discussion of the Ten Commandments, and I must confess, as a boy, I never did learn and memorize the Ten Commandments. If you had asked me prior to this week, what's the eighth commandment? What's the fifth commandment? I couldn't have answered you very well. I still can't answer very well. I think the fifth commandment is the Sabbath day. No, that's four. Honor your father and mother. So I'll read them here. I'll just summarize them. I'll say them 1 through 10. Hopefully you guys can get them in your head so you remember them. Number 1, you shall have no other gods before me. Number 2, you shall not make a carved image or an idol. Number 3, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Number 4, remember the Sabbath day. Number 5, honor your father and your mother. Number 6, you shall not murder. Number 7, you shall not commit adultery. Number 8, you shall not steal. Number 9, you shall not bear false witness, or you shall not lie. You could say it that way. And number 10, you shall not covet. And so these 10 commands are, I like to think of them being summarized in two different ways, where the first four commands are being related to a person's relationship between himself and God, where each of the first four commands has something to do with your relationship with God. So the first one, you shall have no other gods before me. So that's how we, you know, do we place gods or make gods more important than who God is? Or number 2, where we shall not make a carved image or an idol, similar to number 1, where we would make something else that we would start to worship. So, and 3, taking the name of the Lord your God in vain. So how do we relate to his name, his reputation, who he is? Are we flippant about that? Are we not taking it with respect? And then remembering the Sabbath day, the Sabbath was instituted by God during creation, and do we respect that? And does so that shows how we think of God. Those first four commandments, the last six, I like to think of in terms of our relationships with others, and not that God isn't involved in that, but this is how God would want us to treat others. As sort of as a reflection of his own character and how he indeed even treats us. So, like number five, honor your father and mother. Clearly, that's between us and our parents, respecting those who are older and have authority over us. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. Again, all of these things are things which we can do against a fellow human being. And even Jesus himself, I think, sort of summarized this when somebody came to him and says, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment of the law?" And he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself." And I think we could very easily summarize these 10 commandments in that way. The first four are about loving God, and the last six are about loving your neighbor. And so, the statement that the whole law is fulfilled in love, I think we can say is accurate. So one other thought that I had was, I was thinking about this, about the Ten Commandments being sort of a pillar of the something that like everybody is always taught about in Sunday school. And one other pillar that I was thinking about was like the Lord's Prayer, when he teaches us to pray. And the very first thing in his prayer is, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name." And that phrase, "hallowed be thy name," means to give respect to God's name. And God's name is, it's not just like a word, but what it means is it means like who God is, his character, his reputation, his, what he means. So like when we say hallowed be thy name, we are seeking to honor and reverence and respect him in that way. And that to me was very similar to the commandment number three, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And so it was this interesting thing where we can kind of connect these two. And I've heard various methods, I guess you might say, of praying through the Lord's Prayer. And as I was studying, I actually stumbled across one from Martin Luther about how he would pray through the Ten Commandments in a similar manner that he would pray through the Lord's Prayer, where he would take each commandment and he would read it, and he would then begin to pray. There were four steps. It was something praying about what he had learned that the commandment was teaching him. And then he would confess or thank God for that commandment, and then confess how he had broken that commandment, and then pray to help him keep that commandment. So that would be an interesting exercise to go through 10 commandments, maybe one a day, maybe all 10 in one day, but to pray through these commandments. So what I'd like to do here for a few moments, it's going to take more than a few moments, is I have four lessons, I guess, that I think we can learn from this chapter. And I'll start out with the first one, just that when I read through and reflect on this chapter, one thing that jumps out to me is that the Ten Commandments are a reflection of God. So I think that's the first lesson we can learn. There are certain things that we can infer about God based on these commandments that he gives. Things like that he is holy, that he is righteous and faithful, and true and loving. Those are all things that I think show up in these commandments, where he is placing himself above all others, you know, and so like the first one, you shall have no other gods before me. That says that he is holy because he is set apart. He is in a category of his own. And we should learn that and we should apply that and in our own lives. Maybe just one other one where, let's see. I was thinking of the one where he is faithful in verse 6. It's not exactly part of the commandment. It's more of like God's commentary on the commandment, where he's talking about those who hate him will not see his love, but those who obey him and keep his commandments. In verse 6, he says, showing steadfast love to thousands or thousands of generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. And that, to me, was an aspect of God's, well, certainly his love, but secondly, his faithfulness, that he would continue, as he suggests, even to the thousandth generation of those who keep his commandments. So I do think there are things we can learn about his commandments and see how these commandments are a reflection of him, his character, and again, from the second half, how he wants us to treat others. I'm sure that we would have seen in Jesus's life his perfect living out of these in how he interacted with those around him. It would have been amazing to see that. But, you know, this is God speaking these commandments. These aren't just random laws that he's coming up with. They are coming out of his character and who he is. And one thing to keep in mind is that God's law is an absolute truth based on God's absolute moral standard. And we can't stray into the area of letting relative truth, where something that's true for you may not be true for me, and that I don't have to follow your truth. Because these commands are coming directly from God, and because we know that God never changes and God is always true, these are absolute truths. And more than that, well, maybe not more than that, but in addition to that, a lot of these truths are innately in humans' conscience. We know that it's wrong to murder. Virtually all civilizations throughout history have agreed that murder is wrong, that it's wrong to steal or to lie. Does that stop us doing it? No, but generally we agree within ourselves. We know that these are absolute truths, that they are wrong, and that's a reflection on the absolute moral God that we have. So that's my first lesson, that these commandments are a reflection of our God. The second lesson, I think, is when it's phrased a little funny here in my notes, but I titled it to understand why the law was given. So that's kind of the second lesson that we can go into. So sometimes we don't like to dig into why or understand. We just want to say, okay, those 10 commandments are there. Okay, that's enough for me, right? It's there, let's do it. But I think it is important. Well, I know it's important because this very topic is addressed in the New Testament. Before I get there, though, I was reading a little sermon or a commentary by John Piper we're going to go to Galatians 3:19, and I was reading some commentary on that from John Piper, and he gave this analogy about the benefit of asking why. And so there's two people who have written, I don't know if they're poems or stories, or I think they're poems, I guess, but there was Tennyson, I think Alfred Lord Tennyson, maybe, in his work, The Charge of the Light Brigade. There's a portion of it on the Noble 600. And so it goes like this. It says, theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. And so that's the mindset, the side of things that says, I don't need to reason why or make reply. I don't need to understand. I just know what the command is. I know what it is. I do. Theirs but to do and die. And perhaps there is a time and a place for that, but I think oftentimes we skip over too easily investigating, asking questions. The other poem is from Rudyard Kipling, The Elephant's Child. And so again, I think this is just a portion of it, but it says, I keep six honest serving men. They taught me all I know. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. And of course, that's getting to asking questions. And so that's the other mindset then, is that when you come across something, you should be asking questions. And one big question that comes out of this is why? Why did God give these 10 commandments? So there is, I'm going to turn over to Galatians chapter 3. So here, Paul, by the way, there are many passages in the New Testament that talk about the law, and there's far too many for me to incorporate into tonight's lesson, but it's just kind of fascinating. So Paul is talking about the law and how about Israel and about comparing specifically, does the law make null the promise that was given to Abraham? And so he comes to a conclusion in verse 17 and 18 that no, it does not. The promise is still valid, that the law does not make that null. So then he asks the question, why then the law? So if the law didn't add to the promise, what, why then? Why then do it? And he says, it was added because of transgressions until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made. And it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Now, an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. And I'm going to continue on just a little bit farther. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not. For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. But the scripture imprisoned everything under sin, so that the promise by faith in Christ Jesus might be given to those who believe. So I think there's two things here that tell us a little bit more information about the law. Right away in verse 19, it says, it was added because of transgressions. And so that's a little bit of a weird phrase or language. It could mean a lot of different things, but I think it makes it a little clearer, a little more clear in verse 22. Well, and even, yeah, we'll start in 22. The scripture imprisoned everything under sin. And so I think what it's getting at is that the law reveals sin in our lives. And we see that also, Paul writes about it in Romans in a couple different places where, the law was brought and then transgression came because of the law. And that without the law, there is no sin. Or even in chapter 7, where he says, I didn't know what it was to covet until the law said, do not covet. And then all of a sudden, I coveted. And there it is. So the introduction of the law brings about and shows sin in our lives. And so that's kind of one way. And then another way is that it multiplies that sin in our life. Not like in a way that God is causing us to sin, but our own sin nature rebels against the law to increase transgression. And again, with God's ultimate mighty purpose that he would conquer and sin and death and vanquish, and that all of those transgressions would then be turned to grace that he would save us from that. So why then the law? It was given elsewhere. Paul talks about it as a guardian, like a governess. No, I'm trying to think of the right word. But anyways, someone who like watches over and protects. And here Paul is talking about it as revealing sin in our hearts. It's important to understand that why God gave this. It wasn't just an arbitrary reason that he wanted to impose these rules and regulations on us. It was to expose sin for what it was in preparation for the time when Christ would come, as it says in verse 19, until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made. Now, one important thing to note also is in verse 21, it says, for if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. And so Paul understands that the law can never give life. It can only kill because it can only reveal sin. We are not, the law itself is good, but we are not. Our sinful selves and our sin nature will act against the law and turn to our own destruction to bring us to death. And so the law could never give life. That ties in sort of with a theme in Romans 9, where Paul is talking about the Jews who sought after the law with zeal, but not as unto knowledge. And so they didn't understand the right reasoning. They thought they could pursue the law either legalistically or as a means of righteousness and attain that. But it was the wrong thought process. It wasn't how God had intended that. In fact, even jumping back briefly to Exodus 20, at the very end, God puts in these rules and regulations about an altar. And why would you need an altar if there's no expectation of sin? So even right from the beginning, God puts out these rules, these Ten Commandments, and right after that says, okay, now you're going to need an altar because you're going to have to make some peace offerings. And so there's this expectation that it's not going to be kept completely. So we need to pursue the law, not as we saw the Jews failed when they pursued as with zeal, but not unto knowledge. We need to pursue the law in faith, realizing that in keeping the law, it's not righteousness. The law does not give us righteousness or sanctify us, but it's our devotion to God. I guess one way of thinking of it is that God gave his life for us, and so then we give our lives to God. And one way of doing that is sort of as a living sacrifice, as making our lives reflect what God has asked of in his law, in his commandments. And also part of this, as the purpose of the law was to convict of sin and to point out sin, we should let that happen. So the purpose of the law was to do that. We should let the law point out areas in our life that are sin. And we're going to want to buck against that and rebel because we are by nature children of wrath and living in the flesh. And there's actually a really cool verse in Romans 8 where it talks about this. Romans 8 talks about life in the spirit versus life in the flesh. And in verse 7, Romans 8, verse 7, it says, well, I'm going to start in 6. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. And there it is, right there. That's the crux of the matter between when God gives his law to a people that are sinful in nature, sinful. Their minds are set on the flesh. And I'm not just talking about the Jews. I mean, it's us as well. When we set our minds on the flesh, that's death to us. The law comes and we cannot, it says, the mind does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. And that's us. Anytime that we are not living in the Spirit, to set your mind on the Spirit is life and peace. And so that's the goal. Of course, we need grace in the times when we don't. Okay, so that was my second point of we need to understand why the law was given. My third point is when we seek to live out, you know, the law, we need to pursue the law in balance. So there's the two sides of legalism and lawlessness. They happen to both start with the same letter. So there you go, alliteration, legalism and lawlessness. So as for legalism, I think that Jesus sort of taught on this a little bit in Matthew. Matthew chapter 6, we'll be there a little bit. So Jesus was teaching and he was not contradicting the law, but he was contradicting the common misunderstandings of the law. So in verse 21 of chapter 6, Jesus says, no, I must have written the wrong chapter. I think we're in chapter 5. Yes. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. So that is, of course, a reference to that commandment, you shall not murder. Verse 22. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to council, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. So one warning against legalism here is don't, you know, when we see God's commandment, don't murder, you know, the legalistic way of thinking is looking back on our life and saying, have I ever murdered anyone? No, check. But I think that Jesus is right in saying that we need to look at the commandment from the intent of what God meant, the spirit of the law, perhaps not the letter of the law. Another example is just a few verses down, verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Again, gets to the matter of the heart. It's not just our outward actions. It's our thoughts, our speech, our heart attitudes that can also sin. And so we need to make sure that all of that is in line with what God has commanded. So that would be a warning against just strict legalism of the exact words. The other side of things is lawlessness and saying, well, we just don't even need to follow these at all. One thing I wanted to point out in this same chapter of Matthew, just before he says these two things, in verse 18, well, we'll start in 17. Jesus says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And there is a call not to make light of or to, as it says, to relax one of the least of these commandments. So Jesus is upholding what God had said. He says that he came to fulfill them. And yes, indeed, he came and he fulfilled the legal requirements of the law. I do believe, however, that the moral standing of the law still applies, that God is still a moral God, and as he calls us to himself as a people for his own possession, that we should honor him and seek to strive after his own moral law as well. So I think we also need to not go into the camp of lawlessness and say, well, this doesn't apply to us. It's, you know, what, 4,000 years old, and, you know, it's not worth anything anymore. I think that's not true. I think it speaks a lot to us still. So that was the third lesson, to pursue the law in balance. And then the last lesson deals with, we'll get back to Exodus chapter 19. So God speaks these Ten Commandments, and we see the people's response in verse 18. And I'm just going to read the section from verse 18 through to verse 21. Now, when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us lest we die." Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." The people stood far off, while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. And so it's this image of, after God has finished speaking, the people are so afraid, they're terrified. They've heard this thunderous voice come from heaven. And it's this image that we don't often get. We don't often get this image of God in just terrifying power, like the Israelites saw on Mount Sinai there. But they were really afraid, so much that they said, if God speaks to us anymore, we're going to die. Whether it was just out of maybe a figure of speech, we'll say, I'll die of fright, or whether it was they truly thought that long exposure in the presence of God would cause death. I mean, there are other instances of people saying, behold, we have been in the presence of God, and did we live, so they could have been thinking that as well. But regardless, they were terrified and afraid. And one of the interesting verses that I saw was Moses's response to them. He said, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." And I thought to myself when I first read that, what is he saying? How can that be? He tells them in the first place not to fear, and then he tells them in the second half that they should, that the fear is there, that they should have fear. why is he saying that? Is he contradicting himself? And so it took me a little bit. I was reading and trying to figure it out, and I think it comes down to just two different types of fear that we can have. There's the first kind of fear, I guess you would call it a bad fear, where we are fearful of judgment, fearful of it causes us to hide or to be afraid to draw near. And the image in my head is, of course, Adam, the first man who, after he sinned, suddenly broke fellowship with God, and he was afraid to meet with God, and he hid. And so that's the first kind of fear that we can have in relation to God. And the second kind of fear, which I think Moses implies in the second half of verse 20, is a fear of reverence or respect. Something that causes us to increase our love, a holy, they call it a holy fear, reverence, respect, where we boldly approach. So the first fear causes us to hide away in shame or expectation of judgment. And the second fear is respectful and loving, and we have confidence to approach. And so what Moses is saying is, don't do not be afraid of God. Do not cower away in fear and hide from God. Yes, God is showing a magnificent display here of his power, but don't let that make you hide from God. Let that develop in you a fear of reverence and respect, that that may go before you with the intention of that you may not sin. So when we have an appropriate, healthy fear of God, that acts as a help and a guide to keep us from sinning. And I think we see that in other places in the Bible, particularly in Proverbs, where it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I think it talks in a few other places about fear in relation to living a life that pleases God. Again, the appropriate fear of God. And there's one more verse in 1 John 4:18. I'm going to turn there briefly. There's a few verses that I wanted to read. I'll start in verse 16 of chapter 4, 1 John. So we have come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. And here's verse 18. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. And so here John is talking specifically about, you know, the first kind of fear, where we fear punishment and judgment, and talking about the day of judgment. And we should not be fearful of that, but because God loves us, that casts out our fear. Perfect love casts out fear, and it calls us to love as well. In verse 19, short, simple verse, we love because he first loved us. And it's difficult maybe at first glance to see God's love in Exodus chapter 20, because we see this image of just frightful power and majesty, but there are glimpses of it, that God gives us his law out of love. So I think that wraps up the last lesson, to develop an appropriate fear of God, and let it help us live a life free of sin. That is the four lessons that I pulled, kind of the end of my thoughts here. I'll open it up to any questions that we have here.
Tom, thanks very much.
Yeah.
We did want to see if any of the kids had some visual images of these 4 points, Tom, or anything else in Exodus 20.
10 Commandments, the mountain.
Yeah.
Fire, the smoke.
Maybe Victoria does. Oh, look who's here, Jonathan.
Yeah, this is mine.
Do not steal. Can you explain it, Jonathan?
So this is the thunder and the smoke.
Okay.
And this is Moses. These are the commandments, and these are the people. They're so scared, running away.
Do not steal. Is anyone your brother, Jacob?
There's
Jacob. Look at that. Do not steal. Good.
Good job.
All right. You didn't explain it that clearly, Tom.
Very good.
Thanks, boys. Made my day.
Yeah.